Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline.
Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherell.
Offline number 82. Who thought we would have seen the day?
I think there's a betting pool out there betting that we won't make it to 100, but they are going to lose.
Oh no, they are definitely going to lose. We're going to hit 100 well before the end of the year. I'm excited about that, actually. We should do like some sort of, I don't know, party or giveaway or, I don't know. We should do something.
Yes, right with your ideas, dear listeners. All, how many of you? What are we up to?
I don't know the answer to that.
Lots. Many. Multiples.
Yeah, multiples, definitely. More than one for every episode.
Now, you showed me a graph in the Simplecast stats that looked a little bit like a hockey stick. And I'm not exaggerating.
It did. No, you're not exaggerating. Yeah, last month, or this month, technically, we're recording this on April 30th. So this calendar month has been the month where we've gotten the most downloads of any show of any month since we started this here podcast.
Liston, I wonder, is there some sort of viral thing happening?
No, I don't think so.
Darn it.
Not according to the stats that I'm seeing.
I was looking for a tie-in to our topic today.
I know. So we're going to talk about virality and how it works and why you should know a little bit about how virality works and why I think there's a big misconception about what virality actually is in general. But yeah, as I look at our stats, what it looks like to me, sir, is maybe you emailed your list a couple times. We had a big bump last week, and I don't know why that is. Maybe someone mentioned one of our episodes somewhere. I'm not sure. I haven't heard from anybody that that's the case.
Well, I have been spilling the beans a little bit to my list about this podcast. I was going to try to keep quiet about it, and I have not succeeded at that. I've been talking about it. I've been linking to it as for various examples. I've been writing this incredibly lengthy series on how to start a podcast, and that's given me the occasion to link to several of our episodes.
I see.
So maybe it's all me. Maybe I'm the reason that we have a hockey stick.
Was offline used as a counterexample? Like, if you want to start a podcast, don't do it this way?
Here's what not to do. No. You know, a lot of it was just sort of, it fit into the context of like, here's, I'm going to do a series on, this is me talking to my email list. I'm going to do a series on podcasting, and I've talked about this before. In fact, here's Liston and I talking about it in these three episodes of Offline. So maybe that's the source of some of the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is fascinating stuff. We are losing a listener every time we open our word about our mouth, about every time we speak a word about our podcast stats. Maybe we should move into the topic today.
I know. We don't have a single listener to spare. I was looking at your email from today, 4:39 a.m., by the way. Is that when you wrote it, or are you scheduled out in the future these days?
I'm about one day ahead, although that's not going to be true tomorrow because I did other stuff today other than writing. I get up at 4, and God,
that's crazy.
Depending, 4 a.m., to be clear.
Right, yeah.
And I'm usually at the computer at 4:40 or so after having brewed a cup of coffee and fed the cats. And I'm writing, and I get sometimes 2 to 3 hours to just focus on writing, which is awesome. And I think very valuable for my business.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this was written ahead of time. And these are some of the longest emails I have sent in quite a while.
Yes, it is ambitious. I'm sure some people are reading every single word, though. Like, you have this like probably small Venn diagram of people who are just like totally expectant of the next email in the series.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Suckers. No, I'm kidding.
You bastards.
You know, if you believe the stats, which I don't, there may be our, let's say 500 to 700 people who open my emails, and some percentage of them maybe devour every word, which is awesome. I want to keep up the quality so that that number at least stays the same, if not gets bigger.
Love it. Let's talk virality, my friend. So here's how this came up for me initially as a topic. Last year, I published a LinkedIn video, which I don't remember if we talked about this.
We did. It was really interesting stuff. You got, 30 views on it? 30,000? Somewhere in between those two?
It ended up with close to 200,000 views.
Holy crap. Wow.
Which is like not even elevated to the level of like being remarkable on YouTube, right? But on LinkedIn at the time, I didn't see a lot of videos that were substantive videos that weren't like, here's Oprah giving like a motivational speech. Mm-hmm. It was produced by me in my office, very low quality, sort of dingy background, and it got 200,000 views. And so I spent a lot of time thinking like, how did that happen and why did that happen? And it's got me thinking about the topic of virality in general, because I think what sort of the holy grail of almost all marketing and business is, how can I build something that just keeps feeding me? I build it once, like by either the intrinsic value and quality of it, or by some weird coincidence, like it totally takes off.
One weird trick.
And that's what we want.
Yeah. A few episodes ago, we were tackling the question, is just doing good work good enough? And that seems relevant here, because when we want that to be good enough, the mechanism that would make it good enough is a sort of virality, like you got to hire this person. They're so good. They're amazing. And the word of mouth would spread almost like a virus.
Yeah. And let me ask you, has that been your experience?
Oh, that I've dreamt of that? Yes. That it actually happens? No. I read a book a while back from Justin Jackson that it honestly is like sort of how to game hacker news so that you could get posts on the front page. And it wasn't really all that hard to do. You post at a favorable time with a headline that's meant to be sort of clickbaity. I'm not criticizing Justin here. I'm just sort of presenting this in blunt terms, right?
No, this is great. Yeah, go ahead and summarize it. I think this is perfect.
Yeah. So one or two other things you would try to avoid: hacker news is voting ring detection algorithm. You have as many people as you can upvote it without trying to trigger their algorithm, which I forget exactly how you avoid that. And it's probably changed and gotten more sophisticated since then, so it doesn't really matter. Anyway, I got a few posts on the front page of Hacker News. This is my parallel experience to what you're talking about. It was really an interesting experience. It was terrible. It cost me multiple days of productivity at a time when I ran an output-based business, meaning what I was charging people for was building stuff for them. It was the output that I created. It was not an expertise-based business. So that was a costly thing. I just sat there watching the stupid real-time traffic counter on Google Analytics. And I can't attribute any business outcome to it. I think a few people opted in for my email list, which was not something I was putting a lot of effort into at that time. So, gosh, that might be about the extent of my personal direct firsthand experience with something that's like virality. And that's not even virality, in that virality is, to me, I'm going to let you define it because I think you'll do a better job. But it, to me, it was when something spreads. And this wasn't really a spreading. It was just like kind of a big splash. And then it was over. And then there wasn't subsequent spreading. So anyway, that's about the extent of my personal firsthand experience with virality. So I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about this, Mr. Viral.
Oh, no, don't do that. So my experience with the LinkedIn video in particular was, I think I wasn't totally clear on initially why it was happening. So, you know, I post a video, which I posted a lot of videos last year. I'd say at least one a week. It actually felt like it wasn't engineered to like get a lot of views. I think I broke a few rules. Like, it was 7 minutes long. It was very sort of instructive. I gave away all of the contents in the video of a bonus download that I was offering, but that's really what caused the virality.
Yeah. I just happen to know, let me clarify, when you say break rules, you mean like sort of the quote-unquote rules of good viral videos or videos that are going to be effective marketing tools or whatever.
Right. So start, capture attention quickly in 5 seconds or less, ideally in 3 seconds. If it features cats, it's better, right? And also typically when you think of a viral video, it's always short.
Yeah.
It's like a minute or so. Like I love David Went to the Dentist or whatever that video is where the kid's freaking out because he's all drugged up and he's like touching his where his tooth was pulled. And
oh yeah, I think I did see that.
Such an amazing video.
I was about to say, what the heck? And then I was like, yep, I saw that one.
Right. So like, I didn't do anything like that. And that, it wasn't the goal. It was a B2B video, right?
Yeah.
But I think there were two main mechanisms that happened, right? So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about virality is to break down, similar to the way that Malcolm Gladwell did in The Tipping Point, there are actual root causes. Some of them are luck and some of them are engineered into it that lead us to quote unquote virality. But I also believe we don't fully know if or when it's going to happen or to what extent, and even more so, what's going to happen as a result of the virality. So the two root causes, in my opinion, are one, I gave people an incentive to comment. So I said in the video, hey, the point of the video was, here's my email template that I use as a follow-up to sales meetings. And so in it, I walk through it blow by blow. It's a short email. It's like 200 words. And then I explain, here's why I did this. Here's why I did that. Here's, and like kind of bracket it off. Here's the purpose of this paragraph. And I said, by the way, if you want to download my template, just comment, give me the template, or just leave any comment on this video and I'll send it to you. Well, LinkedIn values comments way more than likes. And so when people comment on your video, it's giving a signal to LinkedIn, hey, this is good content. People are interacting with it.
Yeah.
The second thing that happened is, oh, actually, no, that was on a separate video. I was thinking, I got a comment from a guy who has like hundreds of thousands of LinkedIn followers one time. And like overnight, I doubled the number of views it had, but that wasn't this video. So actually, that was not part of the story. But I think what happened is, it was compelling enough to get people to comment. And also there was the social proof element of like, oh, my friend so-and-so, because on LinkedIn, it'll say your friend commented on this and it'll show you what their comment was, right? Give me the template. And they'll go, oh, like, what is this about? Oh, I want the template, right?
Yeah.
And my experience with it was I added 400 or 500 email subscribers in like 2 weeks. It ended up with thousands of comments, like 2,000 or more comments, people asking for the template. So I was like, initially, this hadn't even occurred to me. But as soon as the comments started rolling in, I was like, oh shit, how am I going to fulfill this? And so
I love this part of the story.
Yeah, like, right. This is not a problem that I wanted to have. And it ate up like a whole week for me. And it's not a week that I wanted to spend doing this.
Right.
In retrospect, I should have had some sort of sales campaign connected to the fulfillment campaign. So they get like, here's your template, you know, sign up, here's your template. And then as soon as they get that, by the way, go watch my webinar. By the way, I can help you out, jump on a strategy call.
Right.
I did get a client from it, one client.
Oh, really? This is new. I think this is news to me.
One very short-term client from it.
Okay.
But yeah, so I posted the post and it was worth, I forget how long he was around. I don't know. Let's say $5,000. So as I think about that though, I also hear a lot of people saying word of mouth is everything. And I think that word of mouth is super helpful. It's like the best form of referral. If you, Philip, are talking to a good friend of yours and they're like, oh, do you know someone who does blah, blah, blah? And immediately you're like, oh, you have to talk to this person. He's the best or she's the best. That conveys so much status to the person. And I do think, though, that it's not as simple. And we've had an episode about word of mouth, but I think it's not as simple as just like doing great work, which I think was, that was our episode 2 episodes ago, maybe episode 80. I don't remember exactly. We'll link it in the show notes, but we talked about whether or not being the best at delivery was enough to sustain your business.
Yeah, and I don't think we're doing this, but we don't want to conflate virality with word of mouth. What's your definition of virality, by the way?
That's a good question. So there's a measure called a virality quotient, which means more people are being recruited. There's a net gain in the number of people recruited to a campaign so that it can take on an organic life of its own. It'll continue to gain steam, right? Mm-hmm. So if for every one person, I don't know what the quotient is. There's definitely literature on this, but for every one person I got into my campaign, if they told 1.5 other people and that pattern kept repeating, right? Like that's virality. Like more and more people are just automatically going to know about this by virtue of how good the thing was, the gamification, the mechanisms I set up, whatever. That's what I think of when I think of virality is like if I had 1,000 people on my newsletter list today and it kept growing by 10% and I was only losing 2% of the list every month, that feels a lot like virality to me. The word is spreading and it's compounding.
Yeah. Right. So I think you mentioned engineering something for virality, like this 200,000 view post was an accident, a happy accident, or a time-consuming accident. But it taught you something about virality, right?
It did. And I was thinking about this on sort of two different fronts that like have happened years ago. So I read this book called The Science of Popularity, which is excellent. And it's about essentially popular music, like what makes music popular. And Charles Duhigg wrote about this in The Power of Habit as well. And basically what they both say is you need it to be familiar enough so that there's a category matching part of whatever content you're taking in. So, because otherwise it just feels like foreign or weird, right?
So do you think that's relevant to the idea of genre? Like it needs to fit within
absolutely
a genre. And then that needs to be genre that's familiar or liked by whoever you're trying to reach.
So there's a song right now by this guy named Lil Nas X. Have you heard of this?
I think you posted about it on Twitter or something. I haven't checked it out though. No.
I don't think I would have posted about this song. It's a song that he published on SoundCloud or YouTube and it samples Billy Ray Cyrus.
Okay.
And he has this sort of like Western kind of twang and he's kind of like rapping, singing. And it sounds like country with a trap beat.
Okay.
And so when you listen to it, you're like, oh, country meets rap music. Like
okay.
It's really obvious, right? And like sort of throwback classic country song meets current rap styling, which is especially the hi-hat in trap music. Mm. And what's interesting about it is it's taken on huge popularity. Like lots and lots of people are listening to it. I think because of how different it is, because of like the sort of typical hip hop imagery of him like posing like a rapper would, but like in Western gear and like to a Western kind of song, it is attention grabbing. Like there's a visual element to it.
Yeah.
But then another thing, back to this virality thing, is Billboard decided to ban it, take it off of their charts. It was like the number whatever, top five song on the Billboard charts. Now, what does that do, right? Obviously, gives him lots of free press because then that creates a controversy.
The Streisand effect, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so now it's like way more popular than it ever would have been if they just let it stay there.
Right.
Which is hilarious, right? Because he got the social proof of being on Billboard and he got the benefit of controversy, essentially because like, they deemed a black rapper not worthy of the country charts, which still I don't understand how they determine what genre is. I'm assuming there's some sort of rubric, but I don't know.
God.
That's a moment where the virality, I don't intentional or not, it had the element of familiarity, but it also had the element of difference.
Mm-hmm.
It was different enough to go, this isn't exactly like other things I've heard, but it's familiar enough to where I don't reject it outright.
Mm.
And then he had the visual component, which is great for social media. And then it also had the controversy component, which you can't really plan for, right? It just happens. The second thing that's made me sort of revisit this idea was initially word of mouth, But I was on a panel. I spoke at an event a couple of years ago, back when I lived in the Bay Area, with this woman named Karen X. Chen. Okay. And Karen, she makes viral videos professionally.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, she made one video she called the donut selfie video. And all it is she holds a camera to one side of her face, and then she pulls it away and does like kind of a 180 around her face, and then puts it to the other side of her face. And then there's a cut right there. And then the next time she does it, she's in another place. Right. And so it's like this naturally evolving, like sort of mysterious thing happening where you're like, where are we going to go next?
Mm-hmm.
And she sold that to Beats. Beats bought, I've never heard of this. They bought the campaign from her. And I was like, well, what did they get? And she's like, the donut selfie video. And I was like, but they didn't need to pay you for that. Like, they could have just made it. And she's like, yeah, I didn't fully understand it either. But when she was talking about, so she does B2B, well, not B2B, but she works for businesses, for consumer brands who are trying to go viral. And what I found interesting is she said all the same things that Justin Jackson said. She's like, figure out when you're going to time it, get a core group of people who are going to comment on it and who are going to spread it, try to get it into news outlets, basically try to increase the likelihood that you'll have the lucky event of Billboard banning the song.
Right.
Essentially, like, will we get picked up in a place where they have an outsized impact, where they can feed it into their channels, and now all of a sudden we're exposed to a massively new audience? And that's really what was fascinating to me. Is she's like, yeah, sometimes it happens organically. Like, she did this video of, I think she calls it like, a girl learns to dance in 6 minutes or something like that. And it's her practicing a dance, the same dance, for a few minutes. And then in the end, she's doing the whole dance in front of the subway. And this, like, this really like Michael Jackson bad video where it's like the subway's passing and there's like air kicking up her clothes. And I mean, it was really, really well done and interesting to look at. But she was like, yeah, that was so much bigger than she ever would have thought. But as a profession, she's more thinking about how can I increase the chances of my virality, like taking all these little lessons she's learned. How does this apply to you, dear consultant? So, Philip, do you want to take a stab at it, or should I start to tie it back? Because I have some concrete ideas here that I want to give people.
You know, I'm really struggling to, like, with this one part, which is like, where do these ideas come from? On the one hand, we've got like the engineering, right? Which feels like inseparable from the idea, right? But then there's like the quote unquote creative, right? Of like, oh, someone's going to learn to dance in 6 minutes, or like, where does that come from? And I don't think that we have to answer that for this woman's projects, because that's nothing like, I don't think anyway. We have encouraged people to think like a media company in the past, but that's not exactly what we mean. That you're going to be promoting your consulting services with like crazy viral videos.
No.
Maybe that could work, but that's not the thrust of our thinking here.
That is not the goal.
But yet I still like, that's the question I have, like where these ideas come from. But I think that's really it, is like, there's a mystery to things that are viral. There's always this unknown thing of like, whoa, that was a hit and we couldn't have known that. You know, I love music. I listen to a lot of sort of content about the art and business of music. And you'll sometimes hear these people who are like, yeah, I heard the first time I heard that song, like somebody who's like a producer or a record executive, right? And they hear some song, they're like, that is going to be a hit. I have no doubt about it. And they turn out to be right. And I'm just not so sure that it's that predictable.
Well, so in this book, it's funny you brought that up. In this book that I mentioned, The Science of Popularity, he talks about an algorithm that they've created that they run songs through in order to figure out what are the chances of this becoming a hit. And the reason is, back to this idea of virality being engineered, how do record labels engineer virality? Well, they decide which songs to make the singles, because they can't push 13 or 15 songs equally. Right?
Right.
That's their choice. And so they created this computer program, someone did, that attempts to predict how likely is this song to be a massive hit.
Yeah, I'm guessing they sort of regression tested a bunch of things that were hits to try to find out the variables that contribute to hitness, right? Hititude.
Exactly. And so it gives the sort of score, this quotient that falls in a range.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, between this range and that range, we think it could be a hit. If it's not in that range, probably not. Okay. Like, it's rare that we see a hit in the that's not in this range. And one of the biggest songs ever, one of the highest scoring songs ever, was Hello by Adele, which, by the way, has like 1.5 billion YouTube views, which is mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is predictable, and it's a combination of like chord structure and tempo, and probably timing and seasonality is a big factor, right? So like, if you're going to release a superhero movie, you want to release it in the summer when kids aren't in school and they have more free time, and the parents want to put some money in their pocket and say, go into the air-conditioned movie theater for 2 hours and don't bother me.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that. I've been reading this book by Alison Schwinger, I think is her last name. An Economist Walks Into a Brothel is the title of the book. It's about risk, and I'm not done with it yet. But in one of the chapters, she describes this sort of hot, young, not hot like sexually, but just hot investor type, right? And he rolls into Hollywood, and he's got an idea, which is that he can build an algorithm that picks hit movies, and it doesn't work. So it's almost the parallel situation that you've just described, except for movies, not songs. And if there's any place where they would like a hedge against wasting $100 million, it would be the movie business. I mean, it's just, it's on a different order of magnitude than promoting an album or a song in terms of cost and risk. So the fact that it did not work in this more large scale, highly risky world is really interesting to me. So I don't know, maybe someone has succeeded at doing the same thing with movies, but it wasn't this guy. He had like one wave of success at the beginning where his picks were good, and then they just started being bad and nothing had changed. It was the same algorithm. It just was a different batch of movies he was vetting.
So yeah, it is interesting because you would think, right, Hollywood spends millions and millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars on a movie. And sometimes they're a complete flop, right? Waterworld famously was one of those where the set actually sank multiple times while they were filming. But Will Smith and his agent kind of got together and he was like, well, if I'm going to make movies, I want to make sure that they do well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of jotted down, he was like, okay, let's look at the top 10 grossing films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was in the 90s when he did it, but there are a couple common threads. I don't remember what they all were, but one was like, there's aliens or some sort of villain. There's special effects, computer special effects. And there's like a hero story. And they have like multiple big name casts or something like that.
Huh.
I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was basically along those lines. And, you know, if you look at the movies that he's been in that grossed the most,
yeah,
like Independence Day fits that rubric exactly.
Oh, you described them all. Men in Black. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there's others. I don't mean to be unfair to Will Smith. I just can't remember every movie he's been in. I would say his algorithm has worked out pretty well for him.
Yeah. I mean, and some of them, in my opinion, are like not very good. But yeah, it is funny that the number six grossing movie is Hitch, where he teaches, I think, Kevin James to be like better at picking women up. But yeah, Hancock, Men in Black, I Am Legend, Men in Black 2, Independence Day are his top five movies, and they all fit that rubric. Okay, so how does this apply to you, dear consultant?
Yeah, we've put it off as long as we can.
Well, there are two main themes that I want you to take away from this. One is, I do believe that being so different as to not fitting into any existing category is a detriment.
Yeah, that's the idea of genre, which has started coming up more and more in my writing organically, I suppose. It's probably just because it's on my mind a lot, like the whole brand versus direct response thing. lead generation, I think, has to be genre appropriate. You want to generate leads from CEOs at large companies. Probably your viral LinkedIn video is not going to work for them because it doesn't fit the genre of how they see themselves spending time or learning things or whatever.
That's exactly right.
You know, an intimate breakfast meeting with somebody with some star power speaking, that's much more genre appropriate for a CEO. I'm not saying go out and do that. I'm just trying to give an example of genre fit. That it's an important idea.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly where I wanted to go to the second part, which is looking at other people who have already succeeded in a way that you want to emulate and taking the key lessons from them, right? So like, for instance, if you want to be a hugely successful consultant with an organic lead gen growth mechanism in place, like I can't imagine you could ever succeed at that without writing a book. I just can't see how that would work because that is crucial to the genre. And in order to be considered a contemporary or to be qualified in that other group of most popular, most esteemed, whatever, you need to check that box. Now, that also means you have to write a good book and a valuable book, but having any book is better than not having one. Like we know for sure you need a book, right? We know for sure you need to occasionally, at least at some point in your career, speak at events. We know for sure you need to travel. We talked about that on the last podcast.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that I think is important to take away from this virality discussion is these conscious choices we make don't guarantee anything, but it gives us a better shot to get to that end goal where we want to go. Because like everything, there are substantive, concrete reasons why some of these things happen. And a little bit of luck thrown in there all of a sudden makes you look like a fucking genius, even though you may have been doing similar things to lots of other people who are your contemporaries, but for whatever reason, it just happened to work out a little bit better for you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have anything to add to that. There's this sort of rebellious part of my personality that is wanting to say, you can defy the genre conventions. You can step outside genre if it's just really well done. But the exception doesn't invalidate the rule. It just makes it more interesting, you know, the fact.
Can you give us an example?
I was trying to think of one, like, and all my thoughts are gravitating towards like 80s hip hop music, but they were defining a new genre at that time.
So I don't totally agree with that, right? So let's take one of the biggest songs ever, largely considered one of the first true hip hop hits, was Grandmaster Flash's The Message. Do you remember that song?
Yeah, I was.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Oh, yeah.
You know that one.
Yeah, everybody knows that, hopefully.
Right. And so that song sampled another popular song. This is one of the reasons I think hip hop was, it was an enabling mechanism of hip hop, in addition to it being familiar to the people who already understood hip hop. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm looking at the message. Let's see the sample here. The rhythm track was sampled in various hip hop songs. Oh, wait. No, that's not what I want. I want the original sample, Philip. What were you going to say, sir?
I don't know. I just feel like I'm taking us off track here. Blondie, Rapture. Doesn't that seem like a departure from the genre that still worked?
I don't know that song, so I can't comment. Tell me about it.
No, you listen to it. I mean, not now. It's the one where Blondie raps. It's like pretty distinctive in her. Oh, I think my wife is trying to correct me. Maybe I got the name wrong.
Which is it?
Oh, I don't know. She whispered and I couldn't hear. It's a Blondie song where she raps. Maybe it's Rapture, but I'm not sure. No, I think it is Rapture.
Well, okay, but Aerosmith rapped on Walk This Way, right? That was like a crossover song.
Right. So don't you see that as like...
No.
Okay.
So I think that it fits exactly what we're talking about perfectly, right? So rock was a proven thing.
Right. So you're saying rock fans hated that. Am I getting you right?
Some did.
They in general disliked or hated that departure from the genre. They were like, what the fuck is this?
So some did, but it was a rock, basically guitar line with Steven Tyler's vocals over a hip hop beat,
yep,
which was also, by the way, a sampled known sort of sound at that time.
Just, yeah, it was like a staple beat at that time.
Yeah, and just pumped up with a little bit more bass. It's like a regular drum groove, and the samplers they had then were really rudimentary.
Yeah.
And there was a crossover element. And so you didn't listen to it and go, whoa, what is that? You listen to it and go, oh, that's rock plus rap. I understand, right? And some people, some Aerosmith fans hate it, but it also gives them access to an audience of Run DMC fans who love the song. And the same is true for Run DMC.
So you're saying that those are kind of polarizing things more so than successes or failures?
Well, I think it's a good formula for virality because it's familiar enough and it's slightly different, but you can still define what you're hearing or being exposed to.
And I just want to, if our listeners are like, what is going on here? I just want to comfort them and say, like, I think our, honestly, lack of clarity around this is because, I mean, like, who really has figured this out? They would be one of the richest people on the world if they had truly figured it out.
Yeah. So there's a great episode of Without Fail, the Alex Gimlet Bloomberg podcast. Gimlet podcast. Yeah. Where he interviews this woman who was the producer of Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie.
Okay.
And he was asking her, like, basically, he was trying to figure out, like, how do I make hits? Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, you're not mostly. She's like, but occasionally you will.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, Nina Jacobson, that's linked in the show notes if you want to listen to it. It's a fantastic episode. But it was really interesting because she's sort of like, yeah, you know, if you make 10 things, two of them might be smashing successes. Six might be right in the middle and two will be absolute failures and duds. But she was talking about how she produced Life Aquatic with Bill Murray, which is like a cult favorite.
Yeah.
And she was so excited. She really wanted to do the project. She loved everything that Wes Anderson did. And after the screening, someone came up to her and said, that movie was so brave. And she goes, right then I knew I was fucked. She's like, because brave is code for a shitty movie in Hollywood. That's hilarious.
I don't know the guy's name, but there's some guy who, like, sort of camped out at the Disney, like, kids thing in Florida, and he would pick people and turn them into stars. And he had a pretty good run. Like, he put together Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears, and, like, he kind of launched their careers.
Justin Timberlake, right? Yeah.
Right. And, like, he strikes me as someone who, for a while, I don't know if he's still, his hit machine is still working, but for a while it was, like, hit after hit. But I don't really know. Maybe for every one hit, there were three duds. I'm not sure what the guy's track record is.
Well, first of all, he's dead now. Lou Pearlman is his name.
Oh, yes. I have heard that guy's name.
And I'm reading from Wikipedia. In 2006, he was accused of running one of the largest and longest running Ponzi schemes in history, leaving more than $300 million in debts.
Wow.
So I guess he blew all that NSYNC money if he had to do that. I've heard him talk about that before. And there was a template for that also, which was New Kids on the Block. I don't think he was behind New Kids. Yeah, okay, so it says here, he became fascinated with the success of New Kids on the Block, and he used it as his boy band business model. So this is exactly what I'm telling you, listener,
yeah,
is look for a template out there and try to reverse engineer and build into your question about where do these ideas come from. The engineering sort of foundation of it is important. If you get the foundation wrong, anything that comes after that is probably not going to take off.
Yeah, and if there's this element of, like, comfort or familiarity with the foundation. Like you said, have said multiple times, it's familiar enough, but it has a sort of difference or differentiation that is the spice that makes it special.
Right, yeah. And there are interviews of Lou Pearlman where he talks about he tried to engineer basically the personalities or personas of New Kids on the Block. So there was like the wholesome guy, and there was like the edgy guy, and there was the ladies' man, and there were the brothers, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, obviously he made it work twice with two of the biggest bands ever assembled.
I didn't know. Okay, so it wasn't that deep of a track record, but it was pretty big anyway, because they were big head type hits rather than long tail things.
Right, yeah. It says, Perlman repeated this formula almost exactly from the Backstreet Boys to NSYNC, and they sold over 70 million records. But then he tried to do it over and over again, and it didn't work. He managed other bands that he put together, like O-Town, for instance. I think they had a song called Butterfly, which was like a big hit, but nothing after that. But actually, Linkin Park, they've said, what's the guy's name? Mike Shinoda, the rapper of Linkin Park, said he very intentionally was like, wouldn't it be interesting if we married, you know, sort of metal music to hip hop? Because he's like, I love hip hop and I love metal music. There must be some other people out there who like that. And like, let's throw in some samples. And then Incubus did the same thing, basically, shortly after.
Rage Against the Machine is not exactly that, but it's also close. Pretty similar to that. Yeah.
Right. And so you had a template, right? So why did it work for Rage? Well, that's the fucking mystery, isn't it?
Well, let's try to get this back to our audience.
Oh my God. You don't think they're enjoying our music history discussion?
Well, I think we got one listener left at this point.
Yes, if that.
Got to deliver something for them. Here's the question, though. Do you think virality, like, on the one hand, I've heard you say in the past, if you don't have some sort of viral element in your marketing, and to be clear, I'm not talking about these big hits. I'm talking more about that sort of fundamental one person tells 1.5 people, and then those 1.5 people each tell 1.5.
Some small measure of organic growth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's really what I'm talking about. You've said that's a great thing if you can make it happen, or if you can figure out a way to make it happen, or luck into making it happen. Do you think it's worth trying for, or do you think it's a distraction? And if it's worth trying for, is there some stage in people's business where they should start thinking about this stuff, or should we always be thinking about it?
I'm working on a new theory, and I don't want to get us too far into the weeds here, but the new theory is that in every channel, there will be an escalating cost of sale, and the people who can spend the most to acquire a sale will win, and then no one else will be able to compete over time.
Yeah, that does sound like aggregator dynamics. Every channel or just aggregated channels?
No, every channel. So
okay,
we could go into this more in later detail, but how it relates here is if you can't pay a lot for a sale, then you need some sort of growth mechanism where you don't have to show up to do it.
And you're talking specifically about consulting or
yeah,
just general, any marketing, selling anything?
No, I'm talking specifically about selling high-end services. So
okay.
You, dear listener, person listening to the show, right? You're looking to build an online expertise-driven business. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is if you're going to sell lower price things and you can't achieve some sort of virality, you're never just going to be thrust into like your income dreams. Like that's not going to happen, period.
It's always going to be kind of an uphill struggle. You're always putting your shoulder to the plow of marketing effort. And
yes. And there will come the day when if you don't show up, you'll get no yield. Like it's just not going to continue to pay you.
Mm-hmm.
What I also think is you could say, all right, I'll learn the lessons of not virality necessarily, but the industry leaders or people I might want to emulate and sort of try to reverse engineer like what worked for them, which is, I would say, hard to do from the outside. You may have to like go ask them, which is a great use of a podcast, by the way.
Indeed.
Yeah. So you can go ask them, and what you may find is direct one-to-one sales or what I call opening act strategy, like showing up for other people who've already aggregated an audience, almost like a channel sale, right? Mm-hmm. So like I have a client who gets a lot of his clients through someone who resells training services. Like that may be a great channel for you. But if you can't pay a lot for a sale or you can't invest a lot of time for a single sale, I think you do need some measure of organic growth. Otherwise, the economics will never work out for you in the long run.
We have got to explore this more. This is like really fascinating to me.
I was actually thinking it would be interesting if we could find a mathematician to work with us on this problem, because I have to guess that this could be solved mathematically, which I think would be really interesting for all three of us, the two of us and the mathematician.
I agree. I just wrote that down. Increasing cost of sale over time. That should remind us. Yeah, it's a really fascinating idea to me. For sure, I agree with that. In the world of aggregators, you know, like we would think of social media or anyone, any company like Google, who's kind of owns an audience to the point that they're almost the only game in town. Yeah, I think there's, I'm going to push back a little bit about stuff that's not aggregated because I don't see it yet, but you might yet be able to convince me that there will be this escalating cost of sale. But back to our main thread here, virality is desirable. We called out some fun examples earlier in this conversation about, you know, like when it chews up a bunch of your time because you weren't prepared for it or you just got sort of swept away by the excitement of something that you made having an impact or spreading, which is cool. But that's not a reason, I think, to avoid going for virality. Are there other reasons, though, that you might avoid it? Or is it really just a sort of unalloyed good thing that you definitely want if you can obtain it?
My big lesson from it is I didn't have the infrastructure in place to service the influx of demand. And also, the likelihood that a high percentage of them are going to fit into your ideal customer profile is pretty low, right? So I'll give you an example. I've been sort of kicking around this idea of doing some sort of summit, and that would be a bottom-up strategy, right? So I'm trying to attract account managers, customer success people, consultants, other sort of service-oriented people, lawyers, whoever like wants to sort of sell their services more effectively. And I would give them this free summit. Well, by definition, like I want to sell to the decision makers, right? And so I know I'm not attracting the exact right person, but the group of decision makers is sufficiently small where I may not want to make something for them if I want a lot of attention on it. And so if I got, let's say modestly, 1,000 people to sign up for this, maybe 100 would be decision makers and maybe 2 to 5 of those would turn into like really good conversation, sales opportunities. Mm-hmm. And that would be fine. So that would be worth it. But what I found was if I'm going to attract 2,000 people leaving a comment, messaging me on a regular basis, like, where's my download? Where's my download? And I'm like, oh, fuck, dude, just like, give me a break, please. Right? Like, this is free, by the way. I should have had the infrastructure in place where it was like, here's how I can have someone self-service into whatever the thing was that I promised. And it would also allow them to self-service or raise their hand and say, this is interesting. I want to learn more about getting some of your services. And without that in place, I was just playing catch up. And now it was like, I need to make something else in order to service the thing that I just made.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was fully prepared for that.
Let me lay on you as we wrap up here my take on virality. And it's almost a brute force approach, which is, it's become one of the ideals that I really try to run my business by. I fail to achieve this ideal constantly. I might achieve it occasionally. And to me, that's life. Like, that's pretty good. In other words, the ideal is anything I make should be good enough to spread by word of mouth alone. For me, that describes some people like, not everything Seth Godin does, but some of what he does is good enough that I want to talk about it with others because it's so good. It was so impactful. It was so something. So that's one thing I suppose we haven't really talked about is like just the quality of the thing, that it's good enough that people would be self-motivated to spread the word. The other thing I'm doing is, and this is new, I haven't done a lot of this, I'm just starting to, but like in the welcome email to my email list, somewhere towards the end of that, I say, if anything you see me do on my email list is bad, tell me, please. I'll learn something. I'll try to do better. But if it's good, don't tell me. Tell somebody else. That's my very simple, dumb way of trying to encourage something that could have viral mechanics behind it. I doubt that it will every time, but I have 300 some opportunities a year, at least if you just look at my email list, because I email, actually, no, 7 days a week. So now I have like 360 whatever opportunities per year to do something that has a little bit of virality, maybe not a lot, but maybe somebody will follow my admonition to tell somebody else if it's good, and maybe they'll tell two people. And that's my very sort of down-to-earth, humble interpretation of some of these ideas in my own business, is like I'm just constantly striving to make stuff that's good enough that it could take off on its own.
Well, and here's where I'd like to leave it, just to add to what you said. This is my last word on the subject. If we agree that the key ingredients are quality and formula, but like the genre, the categorization, like looking at what other people have done that have succeeded, and then the final ingredient is some sort of luck, we know that the more chances you give yourself to achieve luck, the better. And so, like you mentioned Seth Godin, how many books has he written that no one's read, or very few people have read, right? He's mostly known for like two or three books, but he's written something like 15 or 16 books.
Yeah.
And I think one of the critical components that I realized is I made videos that I thought were way better than that. I've written, much to my surprise, some emails that I thought were excellent and like no one cared about. And then other emails just sort of came together, and those are where all the comments and love comes from.
I just want to stop you and say, I hear that from a lot of people, because I mean, this is one of the things I'm encouraging people to do, is publish a lot, because it accelerates your cultivation of expertise if you do it right. And I hear that from so many people. They're like, oh yeah, I just farted out this email and I was under the gun. I didn't have time to think about it. And just the response I got was 10 times what I normally get from a regular email. I hear that so many times.
Has that not been your experience?
It's also been my experience.
Okay, right.
So yeah, I'm not saying it's any different. I'm saying I hear it from a lot of people, including myself.
Well, and so one of the big lessons there, I think, is to accept that you don't know as much as you think. Not you, Philip. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to everybody listening, myself included. This is a pep talk for me. Like, I thought I knew how to engineer it, but I didn't fully. And it also matters what other people think in all of this, because those are the people who you want to create the virality for you. And so it's really all up to them. And so once we let go of it, the universe will tell us whether or not it was loved. And there are other factors and other things that we could apply, like other people promoting it. There's all kinds of things. But I think in general, the more marketing I've done, the more I feel like I'll just focus on making good shit. And then occasionally it will be much bigger than I thought it would be. And I'll know where to put more of my attention.
Yeah, exactly. I'll close by saying, I'm seizing the last word here, I guess, by saying that if you think you really just arrogantly think that you understand the people you're trying to reach and you can somehow read their mind, maybe that's true. But if you're not seeing things take off in this way, maybe it's not true. And maybe you have some more learning to do. I constantly have more learning to do. I forget that sometimes. But this discussion is an excellent reminder that there's always more to learn.
All right, sir. I think we've done it. I'm not going to add more to that.
You're not going to have a last word to my last word.
No,
I'm not. Good talking to you, Liston.
All right, man.